The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Former President Donald J. Trump joined me on Thursday to discuss the Afghanistan debacle.
And for some reason, it doesn't make sense, he pulled the military out first.
We'll look at the many still trapped inside.
You know that if they don't get out quickly, they will die. Their families will die. Their daughters will probably be raped to death. That is the stakes here.
Former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley weighs in on the disaster unfolding before our eyes.
It didn't have to be this way.
And Ambassador Haley weighs in on President Joe Biden.
He's not getting the information, he's not listening to the information, or he's not remembering the information.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, please, at Town Hall Review. On today's Town Hall Review, we focus on the many complicated aspects of a disaster unfolding before our eyes, Afghanistan. President Joe Biden announced August 31st is the deadline to get Americans and key individuals who assisted Americans out of the country. While that deadline is merely days away, the Taliban stands between many Americans and their one way out, the Kabul airport. We've all seen pictures and videos of that airport. It's a nightmare. Many families with small children feared their little ones would get trampled in the mayhem. They have given up. Others, more desperate, have resorted to throwing their own babies over razor wire into the arms of soldiers on the other side, hoping the infants will somehow find their way out and into a life with hope. The tragic scenes have been repeated on a daily basis. On Thursday, I spoke about the disaster with former President Donald J. Trump.
We had it in such good shape to get out and get out with pride, get out with really a moral victory. And for some reason, it doesn't make sense, he pulled the military out first.
It made no sense.
The whole thing went kaput.
Yeah. My first question is a little bit long, Mr. President, but bear with me. Your former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said on this show last Friday that the agreement you directed him to sign with the Taliban was, quote, conditions-based, and your former National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, was my guest on Monday, and he said very emphatically that you would never have stood for any of three things. One, you wouldn't have presided over a Saigon-style retreat in Afghanistan. Two, no Americans would have been left behind. You would have never evacuated the military before American civilians. And number three, you never have left billions and billions of dollars of high-tech equipment behind. Were Secretary Pompeo and Ambassador O'Brien right about what they told me about you?
Well, you left out one thing. We would not have stood for any soldiers or any Americans being killed or shot at or hurt in any way. That was in there. And you, for 18 months, not one American soldier was killed. Not one. 18 months. And that was because of the agreement and because of my talk with Abdul, who is now the boss, as you know. He is now the boss. I wasn't sure he was the boss, but now I look at television just like you do and radio, and I see he's the boss. That's the man I was dealing with. And I had a very, very tough conversation with him about what we're going to do to them if anything happens. But you really have to add to your 3 points, also add the fact that nobody was to be killed, harmed in any way, and nobody was. It was an amazing thing. We had a very strong agreement. It was conditions-based. Now, there were many other parts of the agreement also. And if they violated them, you know that, we went in and bombed the hell out of them, and they never would. They never would have come into Kabul, and they just wouldn't do it. Now, what happened is, one day, Biden said, take the soldiers out. And it went back to the leaders of the Taliban, to the whole group of them, that the soldiers are leaving. And I would say that they were shocked. Okay? I am surmising that they were shocked because we had that thing so tight. And don't forget, you, I brought it from 20,000 people down to 2,500 people. But we also had NATO had 5,000 people at our request.
I want to get to that. The NATO had 5,000. We had 2,500 in air power. But prior to the Doha agreement, you had authorized the dropping of the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, the Moab, an Islamic State complex in April of 2017. You hit Syria after Assad used chemical weapons. You got al-Baghdadi. You got Soleimani after the militia-controlled attack the American. Did the Taliban leader, specifically Mullah Abdul Baradar, did they fear you doing to them what you had done to these people?
Well, I don't want to say they feared me, but everybody else said they did. And they respected us, and they respected me, but they respected us. And don't think that the Taliban wasn't watching, because ISIS is tougher than the Taliban and nastier than the Taliban. And ISIS was watching, and then they didn't exist anymore.
What did you communicate to Baradar, Mullah Baradar, the Abdul Baradar who you talked to when you spoke to him? What did you tell him?
So I set up a conversation with him, and people said, oh, you shouldn't be talking. Well, I set up a conversation with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. We didn't have a nuclear war. So what happened is I spoke to the head of the known head, because it's
Baradar, right? Baradar.
Yeah. And I then started with him. I said, listen, if you do anything bad to the United States of America, if you do anything bad to any of our civilians, to any American citizen, I will hit you harder than anybody has ever been hit in world history.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of the conversation. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki argued that there are no Americans stranded in Afghanistan. That didn't fly. And then she argued that the evacuation plan was a success because of the sheer number of those flown out. But Americans are painfully aware that there are still thousands trapped behind enemy lines due to the actions of the Biden administration. The stories emerging from that part of the world are heartbreaking. National Review's Jim Garrity joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I am reading from the last thing you wrote at National Review about the contractor who has sent you an email that concludes about Priority 2 program, which I did not know about till I read your column. Lives are in danger. Evacuations are in chaos. Don't believe a damn word any American spokesman says. They're either making it up or they are lying. And the damn system for prioritizing our Afghan workers is a cluster because the Department of State can't manage a damn email inbox. I've never been so disappointed and angry at my government than today. It is maddening. Jim, that sentiment is echoed by every congressional staffer I have talked to who is overwhelmed by the good congressmen, Republicans and Democrats, who are trying to get interpreters and now, I guess, Priority 2 people out of the country.
Yeah. So a little bit of background, on this reader, or at least what he's comfortable with me sharing. So he worked for a company that did construction in Afghanistan. They built both U.S. bases and garrisons and forts and things like that. And they also did certain things for the Afghan government, mostly relating to the military and police institutions. He listed specific ones to me. I don't want to get into those. He doesn't want to call any more attention, I guess you could say, to the specific projects. But this company employed thousands of Afghans, and just about every last one of them needs to get out of the country. I don't know if you saw the CNN report that they've issued a death warrant for the relatives of a translator.
Yep.
So it's not just like, so if you're saying, oh, would the Taliban really bother with a construction worker? Yes, they're going after anybody who had any work for the Americans in any capacity. And this P2 program, in addition to, military translators and folks like that, there were a lot of, U.S. non-governmental organizations or U.S. contractors, or even, by the way, some certain media organizations who employed Afghans. And these were folks who they kind of, quickly grasped were every bit as much at risk as anybody else. And I give them better, late than never, but on August 2nd, they created this program to say, hey, have your employer submit your information. We'll process it. We'll give you a special emergency visa. We'll get you out of the country. And so this reader of mine has just been, gathering every employment record he has for those years in Afghanistan. And again, we've been there, 20 years. And they said, here's your email address, submit it to here. Well, I have marginal good news this morning, but the really bad news, but for stretches of Friday and Saturday, he's submitting stuff and it starts bouncing back. The email box is full. Now, One of my readers said, oh, somewhere Hillary Clinton is chuckling and saying, I told you the State Department email system was lousy. But that's about the only gallows humor that I can warrant in this issue. Because imagine this, you're trying to get your people out of the country. You know that if they don't get out quickly, they will die. Their families will die. Their daughters will probably be raped to death. That is the stakes here. And the State Department email box fills up and starts bouncing back. The marginal good news is that sometime on Saturday, it stopped bouncing back, late Saturday. But he's still getting, like, no acknowledgement of anything that's coming in. So he's not sure. You know, he says he feels like he's heading into a black hole. There's no acknowledgement of, thank you for receiving, you know, submitting this. We will process this as quickly as possible or anything like that.
Yeah, Jim Garrity, my friend Chris Saliza is mad at you and me. And so I will simply say I get along fine with Chris, but what he said about you and me for raising the obvious question of capacity. This is not saying Joe Biden has dementia, not saying that he's got Alzheimer's. It's saying he is failing to adjust to rapidly changing facts on the ground and is trapped, as older people often are, by longstanding habits, opinions, and knowledge, and is resistant to change in ways that only someone like me who've taken through four parents through their 70s to their reward after 80 in the sky above. You recognize this, and that's what I see, Jim Garrity, and I do not believe people are dealing with it. I've got a column over at the Washington Post, which is saying, hey, folks, wake up. He's not listening to people.
There was an uncomfortable moment where he could not remember the name of his FEMA administrator. It's not the end of the world. That's not,
right.
You know, by itself something that generates a sense of crisis. Let's keep it in perspective that since Afghanistan fell, he's appearing before the country about once every 2 days. We talked about the lack of phone calls to foreign leaders up until, I believe, Tuesday night, and the report that Boris Johnson could not reach him for 36 hours. At the heart of my question in that essay that Chris Saliza found so offensive is, what is the president doing all day? We just don't have any answers here. This is, about as intense a crisis as we have seen. And up until for most of the week, the plan was for him to go back to one of his Wilmington houses. I don't see the level of intense engagement you would expect from a president at this moment. And one of the most natural explanation is that he's just not capable of that anymore, that he is turning 79 in November, and he's just not there in a way that we have energy in the executive, as they used to say about the Kennedy, low energy, as the former president might have said. This ultimately, he's a 79-year-old man who's had all kinds of health issues in the past. If you've read about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you watched the movie 13 Days or something like that, you have a sense of just like how relentless the days can be for a president during a crisis, right? You're talking, maybe if you're lucky, you get 6 hours of sleep here and there. Just the demands upon your mind and your body are probably as intense as they're going to be. But in other words, you're constantly being asked to absorb enormous amounts of information and then make really tough decisions in a short period of time. And I just don't know if the 79-year-old man is still up to it. And I have this, frightening feeling that everybody's kind of known.
Coming up, former ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley.
It didn't have to be this way. It just didn't have to be this way.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Nikki Haley, the first female governor of South Carolina, was chosen by President Donald Trump to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In her 2 years there, she developed a reputation as a no-nonsense ambassador, exceptionally tough. Last weekend, she penned an article for the Washington Post with the title, America Must Not Recognize the Taliban. She joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. In the Post, you wrote that President Biden must not also bungle the coming decision on whether to recognize these barbarians, the Taliban, as Afghanistan's legitimate government. Have you heard anything about this issue? I have not.
We're trying to sound the alarm bells. I mean, that's something that we think is really important. There is in no way can you acknowledge a group that harbored the terrorists that killed over 3,000 people on 9/11. You can't, because the second you acknowledge them, that means you're willing to give them aid. Any dollars that go to Afghanistan at all are going into the Taliban hands, and you can't do this. And it's not just us. We've got to make sure others don't acknowledge the Taliban as the head of the Afghan government. We've got to make sure the United Nations doesn't acknowledge them. The sad part, Hugh, is we're like secondary in all this. I mean, the UK has already said they're not going to acknowledge them. The EU is not going to acknowledge them. The International Monetary Fund has said they're not going to acknowledge and give aid. And the U.S. still hasn't said anything. I mean, you can't make this up. I mean, all I keep thinking is, it didn't have to be this way. It just didn't have to be this way. You could look at 10 different scenarios of how to do this, and Biden and company couldn't have picked a worse scenario to have this happen.
Britt Hume was on our friend Guy Benson's show. If I can play for you his audio, cut number one.
But anybody who ever heard him speak for any length of time could tell that this guy, this was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And, he could talk forever and was famous for it. But you never had the sense that he was terribly smart. And on top of that, now he's manifestly senile. And between those two things, this is a man with very, very severe limitations who is well too old, in my opinion, to be the president of the United States.
Ambassador Haley, your assessment of Britt Hume's assessment.
Well, you know, what I said the other day is, you know, something is very wrong. Either you've got President Biden's team is not telling him the truth, is not giving him the proper information, or President Biden is not thinking properly and not looking at the scenario and able to process it, because none of this makes sense. I mean, the idea that you would go and have, you know, pull out all of the troops before you pull out American citizens, the idea that you would leave $85 billion worth of equipment and weapons at Bagram Air Force Base, which is our number one NATO-U.S. hub, and totally surrender all of that to the Taliban. But more than that, think about that press conference. The idea in one press conference, Biden said that al-Qaeda is no longer in Afghanistan, which is wrong. Biden said that our allies are fine with everything he's done, which is wrong. I mean, all of these things that he continues to say, like, they just weren't factual at all. And so clearly, you know, he's not getting the information, he's not listening to the information, or he's not remembering the information. But regardless, it has put a lot of Americans in harm's way. It has infuriated our military. It has infuriated our allies. And it's going to take a lot for us to come out of this.
Ambassador Haley, you tweeted last week, to have our generals say that they are depending on diplomacy with the Taliban is an unbelievable scenario. Negotiating with the Taliban is like dealing with the devil. CIA Director Burns met with the head of the Taliban in Kabul on Monday. Was that ill-advised?
No, I mean, clearly they have to talk to the Taliban, because that's how we get our American troops out. There are times that America has to deal with the devil. When I was at the United Nations, there were times we had to negotiate with the devil. That's going to happen. The difference is you negotiate from a point of strength. You make sure you're coming at it from a point of strength and not a point of weakness. And that's where this all went wrong. I mean, you basically surrendered everything. And now you have our American citizens and our Afghan allies that are basically, you know, hostages of the Taliban. And now you're going to go back to them with what? We have no leverage.
And Ambassador Haley, former National Security Advisor O'Brien, former Secretary of State Pompeo, said that this would not have happened under President Trump. Do you agree with their assessment?
Well, President Trump knew how to deal with terrorists. I mean, we saw that in the way that he eliminated the caliphate in, you know, the ISIS caliphate in, you know, Syria. We saw the fact that he eliminated Soleimani in dealing with Iran. The one thing President Trump knew was he knew that when you're dealing with terrorists, you deal from a point of strength. He also knew that you make sure you have conditions in place. And those things didn't happen. And so, look, I mean, anytime you're dealing with a scenario like this, you have dangers that can happen. But he never, never would have allowed that equipment at Bagram Air Force Base to stay and be given to the Taliban. He never would have taken our soldiers out without making sure our Americans and our embassy staff and our allies were safe and away. And those are things we knew. If you ever sat in the National Security Council with him, you knew how much he respected our military, but you also knew how much he made sure we were always watching out for our interests first and making sure that we had the most leverage when negotiating with any deals with the devil that we had to do.
Ambassador Haley, the left is arguing that the Doha agreement negotiated at President Trump's direction by Secretary Pompeo is, in fact, the original sin. Did you at the time criticize the Doha negotiations?
So I wasn't there when they negotiated that last bit. But what I could tell you is what the Trump people won't say is you had 4 years where Afghanistan, we weren't humiliated in Afghanistan. We weren't defeated in Afghanistan. And we basically had the upper hand in all negotiations at that point. I can tell you this. Whatever came out of Doha, they never would have moved forward without making sure that we had conditions in place on accountability for the Taliban. And the two things that President Trump very much cared about in his negotiations with the Taliban was, one, making sure that we didn't allow al-Qaeda to in any way have a resurgence in Afghanistan or in any way be allowed to continue to come back. You know, now we see all of those prisoners have been let out of the prisons there. There are no prisoners left in Afghanistan because the Taliban let all of the al-Qaeda guys free. That wouldn't have happened. I mean, I think that's the thing that you have to look at is there were certain things that we were doing to make sure that nothing bad happened. And that didn't happen. I don't know what Biden thought, but the idea that you're just going to go and say, oh, well, maybe it'll take them 6 months to take over is terrible. A leader always looks at worst case scenarios, not best case scenarios. And Biden was looking at the best case scenario.
Many people have accused President Biden of being Nero-like, fiddling while Rome burned. A very famous philosopher once said it's much worse to not know you have a fiddle and not know that Rome is burning. Do you think that's the situation with the president? He's simply unaware of what is going on and has been going on for 7 months?
It really looks like he's clueless when it comes to Afghanistan. I mean, you could get any leader in the world and no one would handle it worse than what Biden's handled. And I mean, all of our allies are furious with us. They're not angry because he pulled out. It's how he did it.
Go to townhallreview.com for the entire interview with Ambassador Haley. Coming up.
I guarantee you, we're going to leave thousands of people behind. And that's unacceptable for the United States of America.
Congressman Mike Gallagher, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Congressman Mike Gallagher was a Marine Corps intelligence officer with two tours in Iraq. He currently sits on the House Armed Services Committee. Like many, he pressed to get the exact number of Americans stranded in Afghanistan out of the administration. Mr. Biden's Secretary of State Antony Blinken praised the administration efforts midweek, saying 4,500 American citizens had been evacuated, and there had been only 6,000 wanting to leave to begin with, a number surrounded by ambiguity and many questions. Secretary Blinken claimed then that there were only about 500 left who sought to return. The Blinken statistics conflict with the State Department numbers given earlier on the same day. The State Department reportedly told congressional staffers the number was closer to 4,100 U.S. citizens still trapped in Afghanistan. Prior to the Blinken press conference, I spoke with Congressman Gallagher, specifically about the deadline of August 31. Is the president going to stick with this?
It seems like the president is doubling down on the August 31st deadline. And what is shocking to me, we had a brief with Secretary Blinken, Secretary Austin, General Milley, et cetera. And there was very strong bipartisan pushback on the August 31st deadline. In fact, some of the strongest statements pushing back on that came from my Democratic colleagues, particularly those who are veterans, who've served in Afghanistan and in uniform in other parts of the world, were very forceful in telling the administration to their face that this is a disaster. And I think there was a recognition by the administration that we can't get all of our people, let alone the thousands of SIV applicants out, or just, you know, women seeking asylum who risk being killed or brutally tortured at the hands of the Taliban, that we can't get them out by August 31st. And yet a few hours later, the president of the United States went on TV and doubled down on the August 31st deadline, which is completely arbitrary, or let me rather say is solely intended to get us out before September 11th, 2021. And as we've discussed before, Hugh, whoever in the White House decided it would be a good idea to try and get everyone out by September 11th, 2021, and thinking that that would be some positive PR win for the United States, should be fired, because that's a huge, huge propaganda win for the Taliban. And now it's also put us in the practical position on the ground of being entirely dependent on the largesse of the Taliban to get our people out. And I guarantee you, we're going to leave thousands of people behind. And that's unacceptable for the United States of America.
Congressman Gallagher, I'd like to point to two lies. The first lie is that we were obliged to leave by May 1. The Taliban broke the agreement at least as early as March when they attacked forward operating base Chapman and wounded seven Americans. So they violated the agreement. We're already beyond the May 1 deadline. There is no agreement and there is no need to go. Secondly, there's a terrorist threat. Every American who's been in Afghanistan, including you, has been under a terrorist threat whenever they have been there. We've got 6,000 of our finest Marines and the 101st Airborne. I know I don't want any of them hurt either. But what do you make of those two arguments that we've already extended the deadline and we're under a terrorist threat?
Well, of course, the Doha agreement was conditions based. And one of the conditions was that the Taliban not allow Al-Qaeda to operate from their territory. And of course, they did. If you don't think that's true, then there's evidence in the form of the fact that we've killed Al-Qaeda operatives on Afghanistan soil in that timeline. So clearly they violated the agreement. More to the point, there's just nothing that bound Biden to keeping the Doha agreement. There's nothing that said we couldn't have altered it in a variety of ways. And I think this idea that you're starting to see bubble up in the Beltway media, that now the Taliban could somehow be a security partner against ISIS, Khorasan, or other terrorist groups in the country, that's what they're betting on right now. And I think that is a terrible bet that's at odds with the way the Taliban operates. So there was nothing that was boxing President Biden into a particular timeline. The Taliban was absolutely in violation of the agreement. And the fact that the president hasn't shown one iota of humility throughout this crisis, to me, suggests he's not learning anything.
We're going to see hostage after hostage after hostage. Is there any doubt in your mind that that's what we're going to see?
No, the hostage crisis in particular, the looming hostage crisis is really what worries me. I mean, the State Department couldn't even give us a number when pressed by Democrats, I would tell you, pressed by Democrats on how many Americans are in country, could not even give us a number. So we're cutting and running without even knowing how many people we're leaving behind. But make no mistake, we are leaving people behind.
Coming up, even the mainstream media struggles with Biden's actions.
I can't think of a parallel exactly like this in recent history.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Peter Baker is the White House correspondent for The New York Times. He's covered presidents as far back as Bill Clinton when Clinton was in office. Baker was also one of the first reporters to enter Afghanistan 20 years ago following 9/11. He saw the aftermath of a country ruled by the Taliban. So he has a unique understanding of what those left behind are destined to face. He joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Are you aware of any situation where Americans have knowingly abandoned civilians in a perilous situation, as we are contemplating doing in Afghanistan?
I mean, that's what, you know, is on the table here. The one thing that obviously is most concerning at the White House right now is that they try not to do that. They understand the consequences, but the situation is as messy today as you've seen. And I can't think of a parallel exactly like this. And, you know, in recent history, it's a humanitarian disaster. It's a continual debacle. And I think it's we don't know where it's going to end, but obviously there's a real danger that it gets worse.
One caller suggested to me Corregidor, but noted that was, of course, in a time of vast war on a global scale, and MacArthur came back, but there were civilians in the Corregidor abandoned. But I don't really think that's analogous, and I can't think ever of America walking away from its civilians when its troops were withdrawing. That's the difference with Corregidor. Can you?
I can't think of an exact parallel here. Again, we don't know how it's going to end and whether there are going to be people left behind. The president says there won't be. But it's hard to see what happens just in the next few days if he sticks to this August 31st deadline. Americans, who want to get out may all get out. That's the pledge the president has made. But then what about the thousands of Afghan allies who are going to be in danger, who will not be evacuated? So it's hard to think of a historical parallel quite like this.
I don't know if you know Gareth Brown. He is the correspondent for The National in Beirut. He tweeted, "Someone I'm in close contact with made it to the gates of Kabul Airport last night after literally wading through a sewage drain, only to be told they were now accepting only U.S. passport and green card holders. The person has an SIV. Is that it then? The rest are cut adrift." I'm sure you've heard other stories.
I've heard stories like that, and that's what it does feel like, that they have reached a point where they're no longer taking some of the people they have been taking in the last few days. And if that's the case, they're leaving behind people who will be at great danger. There's no question that the Taliban, will target people who were perceived as working with Americans, whether they even did or not. And that's a huge number of people, even beyond the ones who are at the gate at the Kabul Airport. There are people all over the country who spent the last 20 years working with Americans, or again, were even just perceived as working with Americans because they, in some way or another had interactions with our people. And I think that, we're focused on what's happening at the airport now, rightly, because it's just hard to stomach some of these pictures. But long after this particular week or two go by, we've got 38 million people who are going to be left to the tender mercies of the Taliban, and it's going to be an ugly situation.
Peter Baker, is there any doubt in your mind that everything that happens to allies of the United States and to American hostages is imminently foreseeable? There isn't any surprise here. If we leave Americans, they will be held hostage. If we do not get allies out, they will be beheaded or stoned, or walls will be dipped on them. There just isn't any doubt, is there, about what's going to happen?
It doesn't seem like it. Hugh, I was there 20 years ago. I got into Afghanistan just a few days after 9/11, and I saw what the country was like then. And if you talk to people that I did when you got there, you saw a country that had been brutalized, a country where, under the control of one of the most repressive and vicious regimes in modern times. And now, 20 years later, they're coming back, and they're not only going to be seeking vengeance against those they perceived as being traitors to them. They're going to have more tools to do it with, a more modern technology than they used to have. So I think that it's a dire situation, no question about it.
Peter, I wrote on Twitter, got mixed 50-50 response. This is worse than 9/11. Not in the body count yet. We don't know what the body count will be. And not in terms of shock, we're watching it slowly, but in terms of the damage to the national character. We ran to the danger. Great Americans in the police and fire departments of New York on Flight 93. I mean, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld ran to the lawn of the Pentagon. We ran to save people. Here we are running away. Is this on the minds of the White House? Do they understand what an indelible stain this will leave on us and them?
You know, they wouldn't admit to it out loud, but I think some people in there do. You know, their calculation is a pretty cold one. It's that, you know, Americans want to get out and that Americans ultimately will be happy that we got out, assuming that there isn't loss of life among Americans. And that even if it means that the Taliban is now in control of another country and the pictures that we've seen the last few days are recycled again and again and again and part of the historical record that, in fact, you know, it doesn't matter to most Americans, that most Americans are tired of the, quote, forever wars. The calculation, you know, that is borne out to some extent by polling. But I think you're right in the sense that there is a different kind of damage done that is hard to erase. The president has said, well, gosh, Russia and China would love nothing more for us to stay forever. I think Russia and China are probably pretty happy right now watching us. Look as we do
it's
on the world stage.
And
I think that does enormous damage for many years.
And it's not just the brave Sir Robin aspect of Joe Biden. It's this article I have. I don't know if you know Nick Allen. He's the U.S. editor of The Telegraph. He has written a column, Joe Biden's Betrayal, Allies Can Never Trust This President Again. And I would recommend it to everyone who subscribes to The Telegraph. He describes a G7 meeting that was floored yesterday. They had been led to believe the president was coming to discuss an extension. In fact, he announced that it would not be an extension. He rolled them, and they are just absolutely aghast. That kind of damage is the damage we attributed routinely to Trump, but the reality is it's been done by Biden.
Yeah, for a guy who does care about alliances, who made restoring or repairing these alliances a key promise of his presidency, he at the moment has in fact alienated them to a large extent. And when he said the other day, gosh, I don't know of any credibility problem with our allies, well, that isn't borne out by reality. Reality is that in Berlin and London and Paris, there is plenty of other places in Europe, there is enormous consternation, enormous anger about what's happening. And they do use the word betrayal. And I think that's betrayal, at the very least, of the Afghans. And I think that there's a real question about where that leads the alliance going forward.
Coming up, Biden has the media on edge.
People feel incredibly uncomfortable watching him.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Don Crow. This week in the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, a special look at the life and impact and the enduring attraction of C.S. Lewis. It's been over half a century since he died.
Probably more people read Lewis now than ever before.
We'll hear from his stepson on the story behind Mere Christianity, born in the context of World War II.
Talking to young men who were going out to die, to give them some form of hope that was not final, some understanding of God himself.
And the earlier war that shaped both him and J.R.R. Tolkien.
And they go on to write these epic tales of heroism where war is at the center of the thing.
You won't want to miss our special edition of The Christian Outlook.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In a number of the discussions on the Town Hall Review today, the subject of President Joe Biden's capacity to make quick decisions in an unfolding environment of chaos has been raised. But the media that has covered him favorably has been well aware of these issues, even if they were reluctant to report it. Washington Examiner columnist Selena Zito has seen a shift of late. She joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm curious, as you talk to people like Mitch Daniels, everyone else, do they think is he lying to us or is he simply disconnected?
There's this overwhelming sense that he is disconnected. There is this, what's really interesting, because I feel this, but I didn't realize how many other people feel this. People feel incredibly uncomfortable watching him because they don't know, they don't want to put a name to it. because, you know, no one wants to be accused of saying something falsely. However, they are very uncomfortable in his composure. They're uncomfortable in his delivery. They don't believe that this is how a president should be behaving. And I don't mean in terms of comportment, but in terms of ability. And in terms
I want to emphasize, I don't think he has dementia or any kind of disease. I just think he's old. I just think he's genuinely, you know, 78, going to be 79. And as I watch Vice President Harris behind him, looking at the ground, she's cringing every moment that he stumbles, and they're afraid he's going to fall, you know, do a rhetorical face plant every moment that he talks. Every single moment they're on edge.
Absolutely right. I also agree with you on that. I mean, I'm in my 60s and I wouldn't want to be president. Why would you want to be president at 78? This just blows my mind.
This is also something that when someone has an older parent, as you do and I did, they learn what happens when people hit 75 and then older, and they don't become disabled. They become stubborn, fixed in their opinions, argumentative, and resistant to change or new information. I just don't know about that, is the funny joke from Saturday Night Live talking to Alexa, but not Alexa. Everybody knows it, and it's just so uncomfortable is the right word, Selena.
Yeah, and that is the consistent sentiment I get from a lot of people. And I get this from people that voted for him. You know, they're uncomfortable, too. They don't want to say anything, you know, bad about him. However, they are not comfortable with how things are being sort of prosecuted from the White House.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Bouchon, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eide, Alex Perez, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.